As Dr. Blackson, my name is Nilu, and I'll be talking about senescence and immobilization. It is one of the characteristics of a cancer cell. So we will start at the very top and go over the process, the mechanisms, the experiments to study it, and what happens as a result of evading senescence. Go right in. We'll talk and start with normal development, as I said. So we start with cells that are embryonic, and progenitors are actually here. Embryonic means stem cells give rise to adult cells, and progenitors and stem cells leads to differentiation. That's the functional maturation, and aging as part of a normal process leading to senescence, which then carry on as the programmed cell death or apoptosis, leading to the demise of the cells, the organism, if you're a single cell, or in a human body, it's more of a turnover thing. We'll cover apoptosis on Tuesday, but today we'll talk about senescence and how that affects or lack of senescence could lead to cancer. So again, immortalization we're referring to as a ability of the cell lineage to propagate forever. Not technically forever, because no cell will live forever. Immortalization here is the lineage of that cell will live for a long time. And that's what that is. Senescence, the telomerases, and then cancer going to it. We'll talk about the characteristics of the cells, the phenotypes they display. I'm just nursing a cough, so if I start to rasp a little, it's because I'm going to cough, so just bear with me. telomerase, senescence, and then cancer. And what is senescence? It's described as a characteristic of cells, a very, very characteristic phenotype, where it's metabolically active. The cells, individual cells, are active. They do take in growth factors. They do take in mitogens. They do have in mitochondria ATP generation and that sort of function. So they are metabolically active. However, they do not have the capacity to enter active cell cycle. And what that means is they do not go through the G1, G2, M, and the S, and the G2, and all of that phases of the cell cycle. So no mitosis. They do respond to growth factors, which only helps with viability, so because they need to interact with their environment. So growth factors only help for viability. They do express growth factor receptors, but the downstream signaling from that growth factors is not intact. And so they do not respond in a growth fashion, so there's no proliferation. But they do respond to growth factors for viability. So obviously they're unable to elicit usual proliferative response. The idea of senescence was first described in 1961 by Leonard Hayflick and Paul Moorhead when they were studying, just the population doublings in cells. And what they found was if you were to plot accumulated population doublings of a group of cells over days in culture, they go through the sigmoid curve where at first it's phase one, they're slower, and then they go in exponential phase two growth. And then they kind of just plateau out and don't do much in terms of population doubling. And that phase three is what they call senescence. So now what determines this population doubling, or sort of the period before the senescence happens? It depends on a few things. First and foremost is the species, and we'll talk a little bit more about how it's different in different species. We'll go into detail comparing human and mouse cells because they're very drastically different. So the origin of the species of origin of the cells, the tissue of origin, and then the age of the donor where the cells come from. And a classic example you can see is focus on the red dots here, which are chest cells or pulmonary. These are chest cells. So if you're 20, you have there's about 65-70 population doubling. But if you look at for a 40-year-old, it's about 40 doublings. So that's a very good example. And then it also it's not as contrasted in other cell types, but the pattern is there, where the origin of the tissue type and then the age of the donor matters. This is all for humans, I would have to say. And then also, if we see the regenerative capacity declines with age, which is also to say population doublings, because regenerative capacity is the capacity of the cell to reproduce, proliferate, and make new. So that declines with age. So there's an example of that right on our on the skin model. What do they look like in culture when we try to study senescence? It's a permanent growth arrest phase. It cannot be reversed by a physiological stimuli. So no amount of serum, no amount of growth factors, no amount of glucose, glutamine, whatever you want to give them, it does not reverse. It's characterized by increase in cell size. So here is a normal-looking fibroblast, and then cells undergoing senescence. You can see how these are such huge cells with large cytoplasm, and there's just really big. Though they've been likened to something called the appearance of a fried egg, where it's a yolk in the middle and the white on the outside. So if you can picture that, that's what that would look like. It has increased cytoplasmic granularity, expressed senescence-associated beta-galactosidase activity, which is what you're seeing here in this, this blue stain. And then to reaffirm they are metabolically active. We'll go a little bit more detail into one other marker, which kind of plays in a little bit later, because this senescence-associated beta-galactosidase, it's a great assay, but it's not as easy to perform in the lab because you have to get the contrast and the lighting just right. It's I don't know if you can see it even better than that one. So there is an influence of the metabolism of the cells itself on senescence. In other words, if there is stress the cell is experiencing, then it does go through an earlier senescence phenotype. And if you see here, let's look at just population doubling based on the plastic dish or a dish layered with a feeder layer of the fibroblast. So if your cells are growing on that, then the cells that are growing on a feeder layer, they have more population doublings as compared to ones growing in a flat plastic dish that we grow in our tissue culture cells in. And what they have noticed is when the cells are growing in the tissue culture, the P16 mRNA goes really high really quickly. So there is some kind of stress that's coming in where the P16 is going up, leading to cell cycle arrest. And that's what this is talking about. Same thing with partial pressure of oxygen. Inside the body of a human and an organism, the partial pressure is not 20% like it is on the outside. So if we go into a laboratory and grow ourselves in an incubator, it's 20%. But if we change the physiological condition of that incubator to be about 3%, we do see an increased population doubling. And they grow for a little bit longer time. They will never grow forever, obviously, but they do grow for a little bit longer. So the hypothesis being higher oxygen levels lead to more reactive oxygen species, leading to oxidative damage, leading to senescence. And hypoxia can inhibit both of those activities from these. This also comes into play with the metabolic angle of things, where there is generation of reactive oxygen species with higher metabolic activity in the mitochondria. So I put this slide here just to reiterate the fact that the cell cycle is important when we are talking about cell senescence. We're not going to go into detail because I know you've already had a lecture on cell cycle, entire 90 minutes. Spending another 9 minutes is probably a waste of our time here. However, we do want to point out about two different things. And we'll just go into a little bit of detail here. The P16 CDK inhibitor and the P21 CDK inhibitors. Now, those two are the inhibitors that are important for the cell cycle arrest. And they do go up during senescence, as shown here, looking at a Western blot with population doubling in percent of the lifespan. That's going to be population doubling, you know, P21 is there. But then it gets really, the P16 is, you know, very little. And then as we move along in population doubling, the levels of P16 and P21 go up. So these cyclin-dependent kinase inhibitors are induced during senescence as a response to stress that the cell is experiencing. So this is a cell on the right side, normal cell. This is overexpressing the P16, and this is how you'll just get a senescent phenotype right away. So again, you know, reiterating the fact, P16 overexpression will lead to a decrease in RB, and that then as we feed further down, RB is inactivated during senescence. I think that's what I'm going to teach you right here. This is one of the classic experiments that was done to show, you know, senescence is in response to P53 and RB function. So let's start out with the wild-type HEK cells right here. So after 10 days in culture, about 5 population doublings, they start to die out or they plateau. They do not divide, so they're entering senescence, as we want to say. And then, when these HEK cells are transfected with the wild-type large T antigen from SV40 virus, they do not experience that block here or entry into senescence. They continue to divide over 50 days in culture. At least that's what this graph is telling us. So what does wild-type large T antigen derived from SV40 virus do? It inactivates both P53 and RB. Now, inactivation of P53 and RB then allows the cells to escape senescence. Now, I'm going to give you a hint right here. Cancer cells, most cancer cells do inactivate their P53 or RB. Okay? Hence, leading to perpetual growth of the lineage, not of that cell, but of the lineage. Okay. So then, what happens if we mutate the large T antigen so that it lacks the P53 inactivating power, but the inactivating power for the RB is still there? So in other words, it has wild-type RB or wild-type P53 here, or the other way. So since it lacks the RB inactivating, it's wild-type RB and wild-type P53 here, and then we again enter senescence. But if we inactivate, if it retains P53 inactivating, in other words, you have the entire large T antigen, but those specific mutants are there, then so, in other words, the activity of inactivation is more important than the large T antigen by itself, because we have to discuss between the activity and the sheer presence of the large T antigen. So again, RB and P53 wild-type will help cells to senesce. Once they're inactivated, cells can escape senescence and lead to something called immortalization. And, okay, we talked about that. So again, just to drive the point, the P53 and RB also are important. So DNA damage response will activate cell senescence. That would be the ideal thing to do, because if the cell's DNA is damaged, we do not want that cell sitting around gathering more mutations and leading to signaling that it's not good for the niche of that cell. So that cell needs to get senesce and then eventually go through apoptosis. So p53 leading to cell cycle arrest, leading to to senescence, or if the cell cycle arrest is able to repair the damage, then it can return to proliferation, depending on the extent of the damage. And the marker for the DNA damage is a gamma H2AX in the histones. Coming back to senescence, because I want to and differentiation, because I want to drive the point a little bit about differentiation and senescence and how those two are a little bit different. So here, this senescence is more of a chronological aging, and it does happen in differentiated cells. And differentiated cells are, they have reached a functional maturity where they're now so specialized to do a specific function, whereas senescent cells are not functionally mature. Okay? Moving forward. So here, that didn't go very well. It seems to have moved a little. I don't know how it came out in yours, but okay. So the differentiated word was supposed to come here. Senescence are over there. So if you can just draw like a big fat line over here. Morphology, usually big and flat will be senescent, generally big will be differentiated cells. Beta gal positive, oh, this actually has moved all over, you can't just draw the line. You know what I'm going to do? I'm going to send you this slide all over again, because I don't know how it's printed in yours.
It's printed like that.
It's the same way.
It's the same way. Oh, that's terrible. I will have to send you another slide, okay? Oh, that's terrible.
And will that be okay with you? Would you be able to pass that along to them? Because this is very confusing.
I apologize. So what this would be is differentiated would be generally big, beta gal negative, little or low motility, saturation density would be low, differentiation markers will be there, differentiation functions will be there, cell cycle will be a permanent G0, G1. And response to mitogen is low for both of them. The only big difference is the karyotypic stability will be very high for differentiated, and it will be really low for senescent cells because they do acquire a lot of karyotypic instability. Again, differentiated senescent cells will be big and flat. They will show positive for beta gal, little motility, and then the differentiation markers may or may not be present depending on which type of cell is going through senescence. The two parts will be karyotypic stability will be really low in senescent cells and high in differentiated cells. Beta gal is the other one. Two differences. Okay? Now, so this is the other one that I was talking about, the characteristic that is now being studied a little bit more because the senescent associated beta gal activity is just so difficult to duplicate sometimes even. And to just even get that assay right, you have to be really good at it to get it right. And so this is the senescence-associated heterochromatic foci, which is to say when there is instability in the DNA, the DNA just shrinks and is really tight and wound up because it's not needed for much of the functions. It's just sitting there, barely active. This is what it looks like in a growing cell, where when you do a DAPI stain. So if we look at this picture, the DAPI is the blue, it's nicely staining the entire DNA. DAPI is a dye that intercalates into the DNA, whatever is available. And then a chromosome 4 paint, which is basically just coating the chromosome 4, and you can see how nice and spread out that looks. But in a senescent cell, you can see there's foci of even the DNA. And instead of it being nice and flat and nice and spread out where the dye can intercalate at every single spot, it becomes really, really focused. So this is more, it's not really a heterochromatin because heterochromatin doesn't look like that. But what the point is that there is some really pockets of condensed DNA. And that's what it's trying to say. So even if you can see from chromosome 4, it's just really condensed. And that's what that is trying to study. So this is one of the newer ones that people are using more and more of. to study the phenotype. And the markers for those they use are HPK9 methylation, which is a marker for heterochromatin DNA, and HP1 gamma. This is like a laundry list of all the things we have talked about, plus a few more. Okay, so we're talking about the phenotype of the cells, multiple alterations that might happen, attenuated response to mitogens, we talked about growth factors and stuff, and then it doesn't enter cell cycle, there's just a decrease in positive regulators and increase in negative regulators such as the P16, P21, the resistance to apoptosis induction, and then they are terminally differentiated cells. We talked about how similar they are in terms of their functions and the morphology. And then pre-senescent cells have some telomere dysfunction, which we will talk a little bit later. The important thing that I wanted to talk to you about is this number 12. Senescent cells do release cytokines, pro-inflammatory cytokines, that act in an autocrine manner to promote senescence and in a paracrine manner to recruit pro-inflammatory cells to promote tumorigenesis. And that will become important as we're talking about how it relates to cancer. Okay, so this is just a list as a follow-up so that when you're going through, it'll be easier for you to go over stuff. So how do we explain these effects that we see in senescent cells? Not all the answers are there yet, so I did provide you guys with two reviews. One is a little bit older and one is a little bit newer. The older one talks about most of what we're going to talk about. The newer one goes into very specifics and, you know, it's there for your reading pleasure. But it's starting to look like there's more of a metabolic component to it now. But we're not going to go over there today. We're only talking about whatever is chapter 10. Chapter 10 is telomeres. Telomeres are repeats of DNA that are found at the end of chromosomes. So telomeres were, and they were first found as an unusual repeated sequence motif in the cilia tetrahymena. In the tetrahymena, it's G, 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 T, T. So it's a 6-hexanucleotide sequence found in 1978. That's when they were first described. There's a tremendous variability between species, and that's why we talked about why the origin of this, the origin of the cells, the species of origin is important as to when the senescence happens, because the length of telomeres is different. In humans, telomeres are made up of an average of about 5 kilodaltons to 15 kilo base pairs of GC-rich. So the sequence for humans is TTA-GGG. It's repeated, and then there is, obviously, the DNA is never by itself. It's always bound to proteins to protect it, and so there's telomere-binding proteins. Each cell division loses about 50 to 100 base pairs of telomeres, and there is a reason for that. We'll talk about that as well. When telomeres loses a critical number of base pairs, it triggers a DNA damage response and to stop cell division and initiate senescence. So that's the current mechanism we are talking about. Telomere functions, they form specific complexes with binding proteins, they protect chromosome ends, and they prevent aberrant recombination and prevent chromosome ends from activating cell cycle and response checkpoints. Here is what they would look like in an electron microscope. So, and this is the critical part, it's the area that protects the ends of the DNA. And it looks like that when we were to look at it in a strand basis. So this is our GC-rich strand because there is a hyperpopulation of G's. It's a GC-rich strand, and the bottom would be the C-rich strand. The G-rich strand and the C-rich strand, because depending on which one it is. So the body of the chromosome, and the way it protects this end, and this end is generated because the cells, the DNA replication machinery can't really make sure that the two ends of the chromosome, to do two strands of the DNA on the chromosome, are equal, as will become clear in a little bit in the next slide. But that's how it protects it. It's the displacement loop, and then there's the lariat formation. And it's important for the structure to make sure it stays protected from the exonucleases, because if there's a loose end right there, but it's not double in part of the double helix, the exonucleases will come and chew it up. Telomere synthesis, obviously, it's the strand, the DNA, it's part of the DNA, it's double-stranded, it will need to be replicated. And during replication, now we're talking about the very ends of the chromosome, when they are being replicated, you have to think about, you know, your biology 101 about how DNA replication happens and the Okazaki fragments and the lagging fragments and all of that good stuff. So we're going to go a little bit. So this would be our leading strand where the DNA, the polymerase will bind and replicate, you know, 3 prime to 5 prime, making the strand in a 5 prime to 3 prime direction. However, in the lagging strand, the DNA polymerase only works one way, right? And it is 5 prime to 3 prime. So if it's, you know, here, 3 prime to 5 prime, it can't do that. So it will make, instead of making it in this direction, it will make it in this direction because that's the only way it knows how. But it makes it in small pieces, and then they get ligated together. Now imagine what's going to happen at this end here. When this strand is all the way being worked over here, like in this one's good, but this part here, there's nothing for the DNA polymerase to bind to replicate this part right here. So that presents a problem. Now, the cell cannot replicate this last 50 base pairs in the first cycle. Next cycle, it's going to be another 50 base pairs. Next doubling, it's another 50 base pairs. And soon enough, there's not going to be any telomere left. Okay? So, that's the end replication problem that we just talked about. Okay? So, obviously, we are all still here. We've come, well, there is a way that the cell works around it. Organisms are still thriving on this planet Earth, and it's because there is such a thing as telomerases. These are enzymes that come around that end replication problem. And the way they do that is by this enzyme, the H-TERT enzyme, the human telomere end replication transcriptase, I believe it is. It's a holoenzyme, so it's got multiple subunits. We don't have to worry about which subunit and all of those things. There's just two things that we need to really worry about. The catalytic subunit, which is the H-TERT, and the RNA template that's part of this holoenzyme. So it has its own RNA. And that's right there. So this RNA template that's part of the enzyme then binds to the end and then replicates, makes a copy of that. So that's telomerase. Okay. So how does it do it? Again, this is the H-TERT. That's the most important catalytic part of the enzyme. And then this HTR, which is the human template RNA. And then the template just adds the TPAGGG, and it just goes on. Okay, so now it's nearly extended, and we're good to go. How do we study telomeres? Telomeres are repeats, like I said, so the best way would be to do it on a southern blot or like an amplification protocol using PCR-based assays. So there's two ways to study it. So when you're doing a southern-based assay, it's usually a probe that you light up with a radioactive phosphorus, and it just lights up the blot, and you see that most of it is really nice telomeres up here. And when the size of the telomeres goes down, then this whole blot of thing will start to move lower and lower on your gel because they are now smaller and smaller. Okay, so here it looks like they're mostly between 6 to 12 kilobases. Okay, I think most of the details that will be pertinent to you understanding all of this is on here, so I'm not going to worry too much into going into detail about how it's done, because the chances are some of you may not even have to do it at any time. So what happens when telomeres are lost and the cell is dividing and dividing and dividing. Not to say that the telomere, all the telomeres are lost, but because there is a threshold. If it's below a certain, then it starts to create problems, it starts to have those end joinings, and it starts to have translocations and transversions and pulling and all of those things. So this is a spread. A spread of DNA in the mitosis in a normal wild-type cell. And this is a TRF2-deprived cell. TRF2 is a component of the telomerase, so when it's missing, the cells are not able to repair those ends, and hence leading to it's just a big, one big piece of DNA now. And you can't tell which chromosome is where anymore. So that's what that was. This is a really, really far gone case of, what do we want to call it? Joinings. So telomere senescence and tumorigenesis. Now, telomeres of cultured somatic cells continuously erode until M1 because of replication. And so, no, M1 here doesn't mean mitosis. One or anything. M1 here is a theoretical point in the life of the cell lineage. It's not in one cell. So with each population doubling, the telomeres in the cultured cell will continue to erode until that threshold M1. Now, telomeres derived from elderly individuals tend to be shorter than those derived from younger donors. As we saw in that graph from the chest cells, the population doublings that were allowed were different based on if it was derived from a younger donor versus an older donor. Telomeres derived from constant self-renewing tissue such as liver and the GI system tend to be shorter than most other tissues and organs. Telomere length is a predictor of proliferative potential. If M1, which is that threshold, population doubling is overcome by transformation with a viral oncogene. So if you were to take cells that have lost most of their telomere and getting to a point where they're going to start seeing a lot of karyotypic instability, and you introduce a viral oncogene or HTERC or telomerase, then telomeres will continue until M2, and then they'll go back up, leading to a transformation. Whereas telomere size continuously decreases during replicative senescence, immortalized cells, they do reach an equilibrium, so it doesn't keep on going forever. They will stop at a certain time because, obviously, cell will require those genes that are at the end of the chromosomes to survive, which is to say, if it gets too close to a critical, they will epitope. This is another, we talked a little bit about the Hayflick limit, but I want to talk to you in terms of how it affects or dictates our thinking about cancer. So let's start right here at the top. We're talking, this y-axis is our mean telomere length, and the x-axis is the time or population doubling or division. So this is germline embryonic stem cells. They have a certain telomere length and they have telomerase function. So they are able to maintain their telomere length at a constant level, which is great. But somatic cells do not have telomerase function, or not as much as the embryonic cells. They do have, you know, like a residual capacity, 1 to 3%, but it's not as great as germ cells. So what happens is, as they go through time and population doubling, the telomere length shortens, as you can see by this sliding, and it reaches a certain point where we call it trauma or culture shock. And after more population doubling, at least in cell culture, they continue to divide, although slowly, and then reach this case-like limit where they enter replicative senescence. And then there is checkpoint, cell cycle arrest, there is minor telomere dysfunction, but they may persist as fried egg cells or cells looking like fried egg, and they may persist there. However, if they continue to divide past that, they will go through crisis and apoptosis and major telomere dysfunction. And if not all cells behave the same way, so there might be a few that will continue to divide or have a change that will allow them to continue to divide, generating genomic instability and acquiring changes. Now here it is important that they will acquire oncogenic mutations or viral oncogenic transformation to lead to tumor cells. Is there a question?
Yeah. What about the spine that has constituted telomerase expression? Would that live a lot longer than other mice, or is that
constituted telomerase expression?
Yeah. Has anyone ever viewed this?
Mm-hmm. It's been done.
Was it ever done, or is it?
Well, the lineage survives, let's put it that way, because the individual cell, there's no way to tell if it's the individual cell, but the lineage survives because they do divide. So some cells will die for reasons other than...
But
in the animal, that's a good question in terms of what I have looked at is the mouse, because mouse telomerase is present in the entire body. We'll talk a little bit more. So we can talk a little bit more about how telomerase expressing cells that are somatically expressing telomerase, how they behave. Okay? So that might answer that question in terms of organism. But in human culture cells, if you do express telomerase as a plasmid or something, they do survive. Okay, and so here, this is what it is. So this is what you're saying, HTERT transduced cells. So they do come off of that and they just continue forever. But it's not the actual individual cell, it's the lineage. It's a little different. You got to think a little bit about that cell is not going to persist in the plate forever. It's going to divide and give rise to a lineage. Because if it persists in the plate forever, then it is technically still senescent. Right? Because they have to divide. Proliferation is the most important part that distinguishes between cells and senescent cells. Okay. So here is how we show senescence and this crisis. Oh, sorry, I'm going back too much. So this is the assay that we were talking about, how we look at telomeres and using a Southern blot assay. So this is a mortal cell. All their telomeres are up here. Cells that are starting to lose telomeres, so ends of DNA, and so they start to look, the pattern looks like this, where most of the DNA is now shorter, and this is entering crisis. Now, if the cells persist through crisis, usually what happens is after crisis, cells will apoptose, they will die out. But if they do persist through crisis, they become immortal. The important thing to notice is that the cells are immortal, the cells are dividing, leading to a lineage that grows and grows and grows. Their telomeres still look the same. They have not gained the telomere back. Okay, so this is an irreversible process. So this is how apoptosis associated with cell proliferation in crisis would look like. However, if a multitude of cells are going through senescence in crisis, it is possible by chance, by spontaneous mutation, that they will acquire a mutation that will give them that growth advantage to again divide and proliferate, leading to cancer, leading to immortalization. So that's where the link comes in now. That in order to become a cancer cell, the cell has to escape senescence, come up with something to escape crisis, and hence become a cancer cell. Okay, and this is just a pictorial of what's going on here. This is the telomeric DNA as it starts to shorten. it looks like that. Okay? Leading to crisis. And what happens when we lose, or the cells lose, the ends of these, the chromosomes and these little red dots, or the telomeres, are gone? What happens is it's unprotected chromatin ends. They don't like to be unprotected, so they end-to-end fuse. Now, these are two sister chromatids fused. Great for now. What happens during the cell division? So during regular mitosis, this would happen. But in a mutated, During regular mitosis, this would happen. But when the ends are fused and this cell is trying to undergo mitosis, these two centromeres are going to be pulled in two different directions. And it's going to break. But it's going to break somewhere, maybe here, but may not be here. More likely than not, it's going to be not this exact same spot. So that's at the point of fusion. It breaks and it makes two new ends. And it can join again, but then since these are part of two different cells now, they can't join again. They will join something else and make it into a new DNA molecule with two centromeres. Again, the next cycle, same thing happens, new breakage. So breakage, fusion, bridge cycle. So there is a breakage here, then another fusion, another breakage. And it goes on and on and on because there is that unprotected DNA is there all the time. And here is a schematic again. It's all in one picture, so it's nice and easy to look at. So, chromosome with telomeres, P53 loss, progressive telomere erosion in successive generations of telomerase negative cells, leading to sister chromatids with very little telomeres, leading to fusion of these ends with dicentric chromosomes, again, fusions and more cycles, leading to a lot of karyotypic instability. Okay, and I think I have a picture that kind of, it's a sky of looking at how this is a really unstable, karyotypically unstable cell nucleus, and you can see there's chromosome 19, part of chromosome 19 here, part of chromosome 19 there, part of chromosome 19 there, and part of chromosome 19 over here. It's kind of all over now. And to think that there are going to be genes that are going to be divided in half, that are going to be under a promoter that they're not supposed to be under, so maybe they're overexpressed, underexpressed, part of it is expressed, part of it is not expressed, leading to new mutations. Classic example is the BCR-ABL, and then P10 with the ERBs in prostate. So that's what happens, and it's not a pretty picture. All right. So now that we've talked about how loss of telomeres leads to karyotypic instability, and how it might, if you think a little bit farther out into it, now this is crisis. Now imagine how many different combinations of new genes are being formed and which one is going to be activated. One of these cells is going to have that active oncogene that will allow it to proliferate and get out of crisis and not apoptose as the body would like for it to. Okay? So we move on to comparing species differences. This is the slide that talks about human versus rodent cells, because this is the topic, or senescence is the topic, where human cancer cells and mouse cells do not superimpose. So we can't really study human what we see in humans in the mouse when it comes to senescence, because a mouse, has a lot of population doublings. I think the number is 50 over there. But if you see, the telomere length is the most critical. They've got about 60 kilobase pairs of telomere. Humans only have 10 to 15. And then telomerase activity in somatic cells. They do have telomerase activity in somatic cells? Humans, very low or none at all. Okay? And looks like, I don't know, I think it's the Google Docs. I'll have to fix this one as well, looks like. Okay? So I'll give you these two slides. Let me make a note. So the critical thing I want to tell you is the telomere length and the telomerase activity that is present in somatic cells in the mouse, but not in the human species. Okay. So here's what's going to happen in mouse. Although it says itch, it's actually a mouse. So in the mouse generation, again, the telomerase is there, and it's going to add in the somatic cells. It's going to add the ends, and nothing is going to get lost, and it's going to go on for generations and generations to come. And in terms of getting cancers, these, you know, wild-type mice don't get anything, so that's great. But what happens is, in the generations, if you mutate the HTR, a mouse that's missing the HTR, which is the RNA template required for the telomerase function, in generation 1, it's about 30 telomerase pairs. Generation 2, it's a little bit less. 3, 4. By fifth generation, it's starting to be where it's now critical, as we see in humans. And this is the generation that where we start to see some of the phenotype that is associated with the predisposition to various cancers. So this is, I couldn't find a very good picture, so I have it listed. I'm thinking it's probably easier for you to also remember when you're reading it. So the mouse, TR knockout mice, they lack detectable telomerase activity. They are viable for six generations. And it's because the activity is present in the somatic cells, and it takes six generations to wipe out the telomere ends. Analyze. Telomerase deficient cells could be immortalized in culture, transformed by viral oncogenes, and generated tumors in nude mice following transformation. Cells from the fourth generation onward possess chromosome ends that lack detectable telomere repeats, and euploidy chromosome abnormalities, including end-to-end fusion. So that proves the point that, you know, that in an organismic level, when you do erase the telomerase, we do see some of the same, well, not some of the same, do see all of the same phenotypes. Maybe that answers your questions a little bit. In late generation mice that are missing that template RNA show defects, which is decreased proliferation, increased apoptosis, that would be expected. In highly renewable organ systems, such as the spermatogenesis, hematopoietic stem cells, in the bone, marrow, and spleen. The ES cells from these lines show slowdown in proliferation after about 300 divisions and completely stop proliferation after a few more divisions. Late generation, which would be about six mice, demonstrate shortened telomere and genetic instability, shortened lifespan, reduced capacity to respond to stresses, such as wound healing, because wound healing requires proliferative capacity, and hematopoietic ablation. And then there was an increased incidence of spontaneous malignancies because of the karyotypic instability that's already present now because of the loss of telomeres or the breakage fusion, bridge fusion breakage cycles. So what happens if we were to cross these mice that are missing the RNA template with a P16 or P21 null mice? What do you think is going to happen? Because increasing P16 is required, or is a part that goes along with senescence. Now they're not going to senesce, and you're missing the P16. So you really can't do anything, and you're missing your telomere, telomerase, so no telomeres, Now you're left with a population that cannot self-cycle arrest, but it can't, and it just continues to keep going because it's not going to, you know, it patrols. So what we see is, in these cells, in reintroduction of mouse telomere into cell restores the oncogenic potential because now they're missing the P16, which allows for generation of tumors. And what was important was that we do see in the P53 knockout, we do see the same kind of epithelial cancers that are seen in humans versus more of the lymphomas that are seen in the mouse when it's missing the P53. So it's starting to now to sort of phenocopy the human cell type cancers that we see. So mice that are missing the RNA template show rapid liver cirrhosis because they're not able to regenerate again, or at least they're and they're subject to genetic and chemical surgical ablation. Telomerase gene delivery alleviates the cirrhotic pathology and restores liver function. So we're starting to see the similar thing that we would expect that we see in the humans with a loss of telomerases. Okay. So human versus mouse tumors. Majority of mouse tumors are sarcomas and leukemias, whereas 80% of human tumors are carcinomas, which are epithelial and where rapid cell turnover occurs. Most of the experimental therapeutics that work in mouse fail in humans, probably because we're seeing a different the mechanisms that are governing it because of the telomerase presence and because of some of these little nuances that we haven't worked on it yet. The answer may lie in the behavior of telomeres and relationship between shortening, replicative senescence, and genetic instability, so because that's markedly different between these two systems. In human, telomerase is suppressed or shut down, and telomere shortening leads to replicative senescence. Any guesses why nature chose to shut down telomerase in human somatic cells? Or forget about chose to. Why humans evolved to have it this way and not be like, you know, mice where all our somatic cells would express telomerases? Is there an evolutionary significance to that? Go ahead.
Well, we live longer, so mice don't have to care as much about somatic cells.
So it's probably a growth advantage to us that we have lost the telomerase, hence we don't have as many cancers, or we would live forever. All right, in human, telomerase is suppressed or shut down. Okay, it's just reading, so you can read. So, now, I think the number was 80%, okay. A significant number of immortal or human tumor cells have no detectable telomerase activity and also no defect in proliferation and growth. These cells usually have unusually long telomeres and they don't have a telomerase positive cell lines. And it's because there is an alternative mechanism that works to lengthen telomeres. So tumors have figured out another way, not just expression of telomerases, to cause cancer. And the other method is this alternative lengthening of telomeres. There's not too much known about it, but there is a literature that suggests that there is another mechanism that exists. So cancer cells can evade senescence by either activating their telomerases or by activating the pathway that leads to alternative lengthening of telomeres. So just to keep in the back of your mind that there is another method that is taking place if there is not a telomerase overexpression. Telomerase is anti-apoptotic. So these are functions of telomerases that are independent of its function in regards to telomere length itself. It contributes to tumorigenesis by telomere length independent mechanisms, which can be critical. Telomerase enhances DNA repair and genomic instability. So think of it this way. Now, the somatic cells didn't have any telomerases. It was supposed to go senesce, and it went through crisis, but it found its way back. Telomerase is now expressed. Now this has become a cancer cell, and now it has all these other functions that are anti-apoptotic, so the cancer cell is not dying. It contributes to tumorigenesis, leading to more cancer growth, and it enhances DNA repair in a cell that's already got so much damage and is living through all of that, leading to cancer genetic stability of a karyotypic instability that's already present. Not such a good thing. TERT promotes cellular and organismic survival independently of telomerase activity. Okay. So telomerase activity and hTERT, or telomerase reverse transcriptase expression, are low or absent in most somatic cells and primary tissues because of transcriptional repression by WT1 in MAD and transcriptional repression by histone deacetylase. So those are the mechanisms as to how somatic cells, or why somatic cells in primary tissues do not express telomerase activity. In case you were wondering, because we didn't talk about that yet, as to what's the mechanism by which it's silenced. Because it's present in embryonic cells, it's present in germ cells. So as the cells differentiate, they shut these mechanisms, the telomerase expression, off by WT1 and histone deacetylation. So it's both epigenetic and it's by active repression by these factors. However, in immortalized or cancer cells, the hTERT activity is reactivated. Now, we wouldn't want to call it reactivated per se, because it is actually de-repression. The repression is now relieved, so it's de-repression. And, or it could be reactivated with MYC, E2F1, gene amplification. That would not qualify as de-repression. De-repression would mean removing of the actual signal that was causing the repression. So a gene amplification would be a reactivation method. And then also epigenetic modeling. Telomerase activity is normally associated with proliferation. Cycling cells have high, while differentiating cells have low telomerase activity. So it's lost as part of the differentiation process. Due to this correlation, normal cells have relatively longer telomeres than tumor cells because they've gone through more divisions. Evidence of senescence as a tumor suppressor mechanism: telomere dysfunction leads to increased DNA damage response, P53 activation leading to senescence. And if it's not there and there is no P53 and there is no apoptosis, leading to cancer, so that kind of ties into how it could be seen as a tumor suppressor mechanism. I think this kind of ties up the ends for me now. Normal cells, progenitor cells, their progeny leading to immortalization if there is no cell senescence. So if we block cell senescence, it leads to immortalized cells. Oncogenic transformations will lead to a tumor cells, malignant transformation, and then metastases. So this is again taking our slide that we were talking about, normal development to the tumor development. I don't want to say completing the circle, but kind of making our lines to relation to cancer. Okay. Obviously, we are in a cancer institute. We have to think about therapy from every single point of view we can think of, and you know, DNA damage is able to induce senescence in P53 wild type, at least, and most cancers are missing, I think it's 50% we know miss P53 or another tumor suppressor, and that kind of complicates the picture when it comes to trying to develop therapeutic models around senescence. There's nothing yet so far, in a nutshell. All right. And I think that's it. However, hang on, before you guys leave, I want to show you something really interesting I saw. Well, at least interesting to me. I saw on CNN the other day, a couple days ago, and it's called, this is a new, I didn't know this company existed. This is a company that measures your telomeres. You call them, you give them your blood, they measure your telomere today, and they tell you how you're aging. In terms of, I think their point is where you can change some things today, so 10, 20 years from now, you might be in a better position in terms of disease susceptibility or whatever. But I thought that was interesting that our lecture today could directly correlate with what they're trying to do. And they're saying your age in years is not the same as your age in your DNA, and hence measuring the telomere size to see. So the point being that metabolic stresses, I think it's one of the papers that you'll read that I have assigned for this. They talk about how daily stresses and stresses and NAD levels and stuff like that can affect today's lecture. And I'll leave it at that. I thought that was interesting. And I also thought, how come I never thought about that? It's one of those garage companies, I guess. Right, if you have any questions that I can't answer before the exam, please email me, not a problem. And I think Anand is always available as well. So.